If grabbing fast food at a drive-thru window is one of the most widely shared rituals in American culture, which it is, then Wichita, Kansas, where fast food was invented, should be up there with Philadelphia and the Liberty Bell, Boston and the Tea Party as a historic site in the story of our democracy, for in Wichita, White Castle was born, and with it the famous square slider that turned the hamburger into what Adam Chandler, author of Drive-Thru Dreams, calls our secular wafer. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Adam Chandler is with me now to talk about our love-hate relationship with fast food and what it means that the whole saga started here in the middle of the country. Adam, good morning.
Good morning.
What inspired you to write this book?
Well, for me, fast food is a great way to talk about the history of America, whether it's sort of the tech fascinations of the 1920s with the assembly line or car culture, the building of the highways. All of these sort of innovations have fast food kind of etched in its DNA, too. But also, I love fast food. I grew up in Texas, where car culture kind of reigns supreme, and it's just a natural part of being a teenager, being a kid, being an adult, too. So I was interested in that, too.
You know, I've read some interviews with you where you've said that you grew up in Texas, as you just mentioned, where fast food wasn't polarizing, but then you moved to Brooklyn where it is. When you say that fast food is polarizing in Brooklyn, what do you mean by that?
Well, there are a lot of strong opinions about American diets everywhere, but Brooklyn has kind of a stranglehold on it in a lot of ways. There's a strong feeling about the politics of fast food, in terms of wages, in terms of health, in terms of the environment. There are all these facets of fast food that kind of dovetail with modern political issues that we're kind of at odds with around the country. So there is absolutely some controversy to eating fast food. And when I tell people about my love for it in Brooklyn, they kind of shrug their shoulders or even sort of press me a little bit and say, what is this about? Because I have no feelings towards it.
The history that you document in this book is really fascinating. It brings together economics, agriculture, politics, and popular sentiment in a way that does truly tell America's story through a very particular lens. But after reading your book, I'd really struggle to argue that fast food is in any way separable from American history.
Right. That's one of the more fascinating parts of this is really seeing, and I didn't know this until I really went heavy into the subject, thinking about how fast food adapts with the times, you can't really separate it from the not just the building of the roads and highways across the country, but the building of the suburbs, how people moved out of the cities and started commuting and needed a place to go eat, the baby boom that followed World War II and prosperity that followed World War II that sort of led people to dine out more. And then eventually, as more women entered the workforce, how eating dinner became less of a thing that happened around a table with long prepared meals and more of something that happened kind of on the go as people were kind of scrambling to keep up. And with those issues come, you know, wage stagnation and all the other kind of modern anxieties that come with our current kind of economic status.
I want to dig into the story you've documented, but before we do, can you define fast food? I am not trying to be coy here. I know what fast food is. Everyone knows what fast food is. But as I was getting ready for the show, I realized that even though I personally don't do like drive-through McDonald's or Taco Bell for lunch, I do regularly eat meals that I grab quickly on the go that have been packaged up for me to consume by the individual serving rather than like to share family style. And these meals come in disposable wrappers. They're not served on a plate. You could make the argument that I'm eating fast food, even if what I'm describing is happening at like a neighborhood health store.
Right. Well, we're seeing a lot of emulation of what fast food has kind of done, often packaged in nicer looking packaging with, you know, more virtuous sounding words. But I would describe fast food as being, you usually get a combo meal. You can't get a combo meal at, say, Panera or Chipotle, which are considered fast casual. The meals themselves are about $5. Other places, it gets more expensive. And then the drive-thru is a huge component of it, too. So it has to have a little bit of grime. It has to have a certain level of, financial freedom. You can go in and order 7 cheeseburgers for $6 and move along your day. And also, you know, the combo meal factor is another thing that kind of separates it from the others.
Okay. So let's start with the history, because that history begins in Wichita, where you say that White Castle, quote, lowered the drawbridge for American fast food. Can you tell that story?
Sure. Thank you for citing that really terrible pun of mine.
No, I like it.
Okay. Well, what's fascinating about Wichita and its centrality to American fast food in history is that around the time that White Castle began, and this was at the end of World War II, 1921 was when it officially started, but Americans weren't really doing much of the same thing. They weren't listening to the same radio shows. That technology was just burgeoning. So what you're seeing with the development of the hamburger in Wichita is urbanization after World War I. That's one aspect of it. But also, there was a real fear about what you ate when you traveled, and Americans were traveling more. The Model T had become popular and accessible financially, so more and more people were on the roads, and they wanted something they could eat quickly. And in Wichita, which...
Wait, can we just stop and talk about one of the other things people feared about eating? People feared ground beef.
Right, exactly. So everyone knows from their probably sophomore high school English class, the importance of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle and the importance of how it affected food laws in our country. So there was this real fear about what you ate when you went out, and ground beef was extremely unpopular, which is crazy if you think about it. We're a meat-eating country, even though there are some changes happening. The hamburger is the national meal, and that all began with White Castle. What they did was they started to prepare these burgers, and they'd grind the meat in full view of everyone in the restaurant to show this is where the meat is coming from. It's not from a stockyard. It is being ground right here, and it's cooked in full view of the people eating it in a beautiful, pristine, stainless steel and white tile kitchen. And so that was sort of what they sought to do, was to sort of make these meals in front of people and reassure them, because there was no reassurance at the time. There was no uniform health code. You could go out and eat at any given place and you would have no idea where the food came from or whether it was safe. And so what White Castle did was create the exact same experience over and over again. All their stores looked the same. All their servers looked the same. They dressed the same way, and the food was prepared in the exact same manner.
The rules for the servers also were really intense. There's like a code of conduct.
Exactly. Yeah, it was. I want to say a 27-point checklist of very intense things. You have to have a clean shave. Be prepared to speak politely. Correct your bad breath. All kinds of things that are, you know, things that you would hope to have as a diner, but again, really intense sort of rigorous code of conduct. You're right.
So this is all happening at a very particular moment where people had particular fears. And what do you think it is about the Wichita location, just quickly?
Well, Wichita was seeing urbanization really kind of come into this. There was an oil boom. And so the population was growing. People were moving into the cities. And they opened White Castles near factories, and it sort of served initially as a place for people to go on their lunch breaks and eat cheaply. So there's the accessibility of it, the fact that it's fast and it's not too expensive. And Wichita itself was sort of home to the Kansas cow towns that we talk about in Western movies. So there really is this romantic idea of this is where, in the center of the country, you got your beef, and it went out to the rest of the country from there.
Adam Chandler, author of Drive Through Dreams. We have to take a break, but stay with me for a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and you're hearing an unexpected story about the history of Kansas and the relevance of that history throughout America today. This is Quintessential Central Standard happening right now. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking to the author of a book called Drive Through Dreams. It documents the history of fast food in America as really an ethnographic phenomenon. The story begins in Wichita, Kansas, at White Castle, and the author is Adam Chandler. Hi again, Adam.
Hello.
So where were we in the story of White Castle? I believe we were at the sort of ideal location of Wichita.
Right. You have so much history in Wichita that speaks to American industry. You have Cessna and Boeing. You have even the Coke Industries. You have all of these different sort of facets that speak to innovation happening, plus, you know, the benefit of an oil boom around the time that White Castle started. So it seemed like a perfect location. Plus, you have the cattle.
A part of the story that we have not yet heard is that before White Castle, the hamburger was just a sandwich among sandwiches. Like, it didn't hold a special place in the American culinary pantheon. It had not been standardized or taken on iconic status. How did White Castle change that?
Well, White Castle had the benefit of Billy Ingram, who is a famous 1920s marketeer in that old kind of huckster mold that we, you know, that Barnum-esque kind of thing, where, you know, he fell in love with the product. He met Walt Anderson, the man who is often credited with creating the hamburger as we know it today. And he saw this product and he said, I want to turn this into our national meal. And as I sort of talked about a little bit before, the idea that Americans were listening to the same radio shows, were starting to tune into the same movies, were experiencing culture unified for the first time in American history. And more and more were living in cities. The 1920 census showed more Americans living in cities for the first time in history. So you had all these factors. And then you have this one guy who is obsessed with this product.
Okay,
slider.
Can we say what the product is a little bit in a little bit more detail? Like, the bun is a new innovation. Like, so many things about it that I take for granted are like come together with this slider at White Castle.
It is magic. It is magic. So Walt Anderson is a fry cook who is making meatballs on a griddle, and he's frustrated because it's taking too long to cook, and he's trying to make everything happen quickly in his business. So he smashes them flat with a spatula, and they cook really quickly. And the next thing you know, he's making these over and over and over again, and he opens one store, and he opens two more stores, and that's where his path kind of crosses with Billy Ingram, who says, you know what, we need to market this. We need to turn this into our national sandwich. It represents who we are. We are an on-the-go, hungry kind of nation. So what was innovative about it wasn't just that it cooked quickly, but they were instead of having two slices of bread, it was a bun. And the bun kind of held the juices. If anyone's had a really juicy, sloppy burger, you know one of the best parts about it is biting into a bun that might fall apart at any given moment. There's something almost exciting about that, right? And so the bun was this kind of sturdy holster for the patty. And people would buy them by the sack, which was the initial sort of slogan for White Castle, buy them by the sack. And you'd buy six or seven or a dozen sliders and you'd take them on the go in your Model T and you could eat them. And they wouldn't necessarily fall apart. And it was delicious.
So the chapter that you write on White Castle begins with a request that came in at the White Castle corporate headquarters for permission to include a White Castle slider in the design for an urn to hold the remains of a woman who'd shared meaningful memories with her sister at White Castle, like in our own time. So you're taking us back to olden times, but this woman, it's part of her story, too. Can you tell that story?
Absolutely. This is one of my favorite stories in the entire book, is sort of hearing about a woman who was terminally ill and living in New Jersey, and her sister would visit her, and the two of them would sneak out of the hospital after treatments, and they would go to a White Castle, and they would just have a couple of sliders and talk about life and forget about their problems for a while. And there's something very relatable about that. I think we all kind of know that experience of needing a break, wanting something to kind of take our mind off of things, and food is central to that experience. So this woman, her name is Mel Burrows, when she passed, her sisters decided, I want to have her remains in a White Castle urn. And they had this motto, which was, let's treat ourselves. And that was also on the urn. But to create this urn, this specialized urn, they had to get permission from White Castle, otherwise possible legal troubles. But White Castle heard the story and was extremely enthusiastic about it. So it really is a touching sort of idea of, we all want these sort of reprieves from life, from the difficulties of life, and going out and having, you know, a couple of dollar burgers and just kind of sitting and not worrying about things for a while is an extremely relatable thing.
You know, and it's also, I mean, you write about so many stories where people are kind of like teenagers sneaking off to get a burger or something like that. There is something about the car and the teenageriness. I can't quite put my finger on it.
Well, I've thought a lot about this, and I hear a lot of stories of people who remember, you know, sneaking out of high school with their friends at lunchtime to go to Taco Bell. Or for me, I grew up in Texas, and there's a chain called Whataburger, which is its own Texas thing. And my friends and I would have Whataburger right before we went to go home for our curfews at midnight. We were generally rule followers, but that was sacred to us, that experience of having one last kind of fun insinuation of our independence as you know, teens in Houston. That was what we did. And everyone kind of has these stories, these really nice stories of, you know, going to a place after a baseball game or after a birthday party when you're a kid, going to a McDonald's. So yeah. These kind of resonate.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We will hear more about not just White Castle in Wichita, but the fast food chains where Americans have made memories all over this country. What do these places that we so often dismiss really say about us and who we are as a nation? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I've been chatting this morning with Adam Chandler, author of Drive-Through Dreams, a book intended to add nuance to the conversation about fast food. And Adam, this is not Fast Food Nation. It's not a rallying cry. It's really driven by curiosity.
Yeah, it's really... I was surprised by the history of fast food as it sort of relates to not just modern life, but where we've come as a country, and I found really unexpected things that kind of blew my mind along the way.
So we have talked a lot about White Castle, the first fast food chain in the country because it started in Wichita. I have just a couple more details about that I would like to bring up before we move on. First of all, the Craver's Hall of Fame is something that I find fascinating just in that it exists. Can you explain what that is and why it's significant?
Right. Well, every year, thousands of applicants try their hand at getting into the White Castle Craver's Hall of Fame, which is sort of a demonstration of your loyalty to White Castle. And people submit different stories about what role the restaurant plays in their lives and why they believe they're worthy of enshrinement. And it's amazing. The stories that you see, it's all sort of on White Castle's website. But
Do you have a favorite one?
Oh, there's one about an accountant in the Bronx who every week for 218 weeks would have his Sunday dinner at White Castle. And one week he was coming back from work in Virginia and a snowstorm got in his way. And he took a $300 cab in an overnight train just so he could make it for his Sunday ritual. And I think that's just amazing. It's fanatical, but it's also, again, it's... The things that give us comfort are inherently kind of fanatical sometimes. So I really love that story.
Yeah, and there is also, I feel like, this current line of thinking where we kind of put special meaning over on one side with the quaint little places that are, you know, on some street corner that belong strictly just to the community around them. And then we dismiss the fast food chains as somehow being places that can't have room for deeply held personal memories on that individual level. But the story you just told really debunks that.
Right. I think that is one thing that fast food doesn't get enough credit for, which is, again, this goes back to White Castle, this familiarity, this convenience, this going into a place and knowing exactly what you're going to get. And that means if you're on the road somewhere unfamiliar and maybe you have a crying four-year-old in the backseat of your car, the idea of a happy meal is something that immediately can bring a crying spree under command and control. So there are these aspects of it. For me, when I go to the airport and I'm stressed out, I like to find my way to a Burger King or to a Wendy's and to have something before I fly, just because it calms me down. It's familiar and it kind of resets.
Yeah, I think you wrote something like the stress of the airplane, like that a soggy turkey wrap is not a salve for that.
Exactly. Having a slightly damp $12 turkey wrap is not going to make me feel any better about where I'm going. And having something that I know exactly what I'm getting when I open the bag makes me feel better.
You write that Wichita is an unsung, uniquely American city that should hold Mount Rushmore-esque significance in the national imagination.
Yes, I do believe that. So across the reporting this book, I drove cross country and I spent the most time in Kansas. I do have to give a shout out to the Cozy Inn in Salina, which is still represents the original White Castle. It's 93 years, 90, I guess it's almost 100 years old now, and they serve burgers on the same grill. And that all stems from Wichita. And Wichita, again, it really has this Americana aspect of when you think about American industry, when you think about, again, it's Cessna, it's Boeing, it's Hattie McDaniels, it's Dennis the Menace was written to take place in Wichita, even though its creator never went there. There's something about the idea of Wichita that really speaks to not just wholesomeness, but innovation.
White Castle does still exist, but it hasn't exploded in quite the same way as like a McDonald's or Taco Bell. Why is that?
Well, Billy Ingram, in all of his marketing prowess, also wanted to have a conservative view of growth. He never wanted to lose control of franchises. So basically, it's still privately held. It's held by the Ingram family, and it's based in Columbus now. But instead of sort of branching out to franchisees and being swooped up by a major corporation, it's still owned by the family. And so they maintain a measure of control, but they're also a little bit smaller because of that.
You say that, you know, we've talked about the different aspects of American history that you can't separate from fast food. One of the things we haven't talked about is the role of the Depression of the 1930s and then the sort of spirit that followed in the recovery period. Can you talk about why the memory of the Great Depression is significant to this story?
Well, I think when we talk about the Great Depression, we talk about its effect on America, it really sort of elicits this sense of feeling helpless and feeling hopeless and also kind of a lingering psychological effect about how we eat, the idea of wasting food, the idea of spending too much on food, really is a pervasive sentiment. And that has to do as much with the Great Depression as it does with immigrant populations in the United States who came with their pockets empty. We weren't a prosperous nation until after World War II, and we're still, by many stretches of the imagination, not a prosperous nation in a lot of corners. So having food that is accessible and cheap and quick is something that is a cherished part of our sort of scrappy upbringing. It's part of how we sort of formulate ourselves. And the Great Depression really reinforced those ideas of you really have to be careful about how you spend money, about what you dine out on, what you eat when you're hungry. And I think fast food kind of coming of age in the years following that kind of speaks to that ambivalence about being too extravagant, about living too hard. It's really fascinating part of our country.
You aren't uncritical of fast food, but you do see it as the system that was destined to arise out of our agricultural policy as well. Can you just briefly touch on that?
Right. Well, there are a lot of reasons why eating fast food is extremely inexpensive. And a lot of that has to do with our agricultural policy, which places, corn at the center of it and makes products artificially inexpensive. And I think a lot of the focus goes to the consumer. The consumer should be eating something different if you're listening to certain critiques of fast food. But really, I think the consumer is doing the best that they can do to get by. And we kind of need more systemic change to sort of level the playing field in terms of wages, in terms of what's, better food for you that is a little less expensive, or finding ways to food systems that are more sustainable. So it's very complicated.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now we'll be back shortly with some fast food fun facts. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. We're talking with the author of Drive Through Dreams about the history of fast food in America, Adam Chandler. Hello again.
Hi.
This book is full of ideas. It also includes a lot of what I have been calling fun facts about fast food. Forgive me for not knowing this one already, but the fact of Colonel Sanders being a real guy, even though he wasn't actually a colonel, gave me a little thrill.
Colonel Sanders is really, first of all, his life story is completely bonkers, but also, the fact that he's this corporatized image who is a real person is fantastic and amazing to see.
So tell his backstory, because bonkers is the perfect word for it.
The story, it's actual full books have been written about the life of Colonel Sanders because it is so completely insane and complex, but he sold chicken on the side of the road during the Great Depression at a gas station. That's kind of how his story Well, one of his many stories begins, and during this time, he actually shot one of his gas station rivals in a feud over territory. So here's this real crazy kind of frequently cursing, very maniacal man who wanted to perfect this chicken recipe and managed to do so. And he didn't find fame until in 60s and 70s. He was broke at age 66. And he went out on the road with this recipe and convinced all of these mom and pop shops to start serving his chicken. And the next thing you knew, he had this empire, and eventually he got bought out. And it's such an American story, this kind of American dream. He came from kind of frontier poverty and
He was taking care of his younger siblings at five.
Right.
Five.
His father died. Yeah, his father died when he was young, and his mother had to go work in town, and he had to learn how to cook to prepare food for his younger siblings, and that's how he got started. When he was five, I don't even remember what I was doing. I was definitely watching cartoons. I wasn't cooking for siblings.
Yeah. Some of the popular fast food chains you write about are national, but other ones are very specific to like a region or a state, and I enjoyed kind of going through that map of the United States by fast food, by regional fast food. So the Midwest, we're Sonic.
Right. The Heartland area, it's sort of an Oklahoma chain, but then you have, there's so many. The Midwest has so many great chains. You have Steak and Shake, which created the steak burger. You have Dairy Queen was founded in the Midwest. You have so many wonderful. Made Right is another smaller chain. Culver's is a Wisconsin chain. You have so many in the area. And then on the coasts, everyone has these, you know, chains that are super passionate about In-N-Out in California, which if you're from California, you'll get in a fight with someone from Texas who says, I think Whataburger is better than In-N-Out. And then you have all these chicken chains. There's Popeyes, and there is Bojangles and Chick-fil-A. It's really, it's the way we root for sports is kind of the way we root for our regional fast food chains.
The story of Pollo Loco in Florida was one of the most intense stories in this book. It's about like inequality and foreign policy. Can you give the sort of capsule version of that story?
Right. Well, It started in Mexico, in Sinaloa, Mexico, and it worked its way into the United States in the 1980s. And there was some resistance to international fast food making its way into the United States, even though American fast food went abroad. But it managed all kinds of wonderful success along the way.
Did it surprise you to stumble on this level of depth and complexity as you sought to understand something as seemingly simple as fast food?
Absolutely. I think the story of fast food really kind of gets reduced to, either good or bad. And there really is a wild middle ground where there are people who love it for extremely complicated reasons and for extremely relatable reasons. And the history of it is fascinating, too, in that it reflects all these American values. The founders of fast food across the companies have these amazing biographies. Colonel Sanders, we already mentioned, but Dave Thomas of Wendy's fame was an orphan who kind of struck out on his own in his teens and eventually founded Wendy's. He was actually a mentee of Colonel Sanders. Ray Kroc is who took McDonald's to become an international brand, was kind of a broke salesman running around the country selling milkshake machines and paper cups for many, many years. There are so many stories just like this, the mom and pop shop kind of mentality that really is how fast food started.
Did you eat a lot of fast food in researching this book?
I did eat a lot of fast food. I ate a ton of fast food. I eat fast food pretty regularly, I have to admit, but I went on a full high-calorie Rumspringer when I went sort of across country. I tried everything I could, and
did anything surprise you? Like, because for people who maybe don't eat as much fast food and are only going to, like, quote-unquote indulge once in a while, is there a new thing out there that you're like, man, like, this is it. This is it, guys.
What surprised me more was the experience of going to certain places, stopping in a small town and seeing sort of seniors gathering at 9 o'clock in the morning to meet with their friends and hang out. that was one part of the experience that I really didn't anticipate seeing everywhere I went as a third spot, as a meeting place for people go.
When you say seniors, you're talking teenagers or?
Oh, I'm talking about older Americans, not seniors in high school, older Americans, but also seniors after school definitely hang out there. It's an unexpected meeting place, and I found that to be really compelling because it really is a democratic place. 96% of Americans eat fast food every year. 80% of Americans eat fast food every month, and those are wild statistics that include everybody. Everybody goes there.
That is a wrap, but Adam Chambers, author of Drive-Thru Dreams, thank you so much. And
thanks,
I should say Adam Chandler. That is a wrap for this edition of Central Standard. Today's show is produced by Melody Rowell with help from intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.